Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Anthony Vuvolo. I'm the Deputy Director and Research Director here at the Lowe Institute. And it's a pleasure to have you with us here this afternoon. We're here to launch a new Lowe Institute report, Indonesian Students in Egypt and Turkey. This is the report here. There are some copies over there. Please grab one. It's also available online if you don't want to burden yourself with a paper copy here. The paper is a joint production between the Lowe Institute and the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta, headed by Sydney Jones. It's a three-way authored project, myself, Navat Naranya, and Sydney Jones. It's a project that has had a long gestation, and we'll talk to you about some of the ins and outs of that today. But first, I should introduce my fellow speakers today. At the end, we have Sydney Jones. And Sydney, certainly for Indonesia Watchers, hardly requires much introduction these days. She's the director of the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta. From 2002 to 2013, she worked for the International Crisis Group in Indonesia. She's also worked for the Ford Foundation in Jakarta, for Amnesty International in London, and for Human Rights Watch in New York. To my left, Navat Naranya is an analyst with the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta. Before joining IPAC in 2014, she worked as a researcher on terrorism and radicalisation in Indonesia at the Centre of Excellence for National Security there at the Rajaratnam School. So please join me in welcoming my co-authors. So to the report itself, as any of you that have followed some of my work here in the Institute, certainly when I joined the Institute 12 years ago now, I've had a long interest in the connections between Indonesia and the Middle East. And it was that interest that inspired me to kind of talk to Sydney about having a look at one of the main conduits of ideas between ideas and thinking and models of activism between the Middle East and Indonesia, Indonesian students studying in the region. And what interested me in particular and what interested Sydney was what impact the last five or six years of turmoil in the Middle East was having on those students. How did they view it? What implications were they drawing from those events for Indonesia? What relevance did they see of those events for Indonesia? So we cooked up the idea to send a researcher to go and interview students. We focused on two particular countries, Egypt, which has traditionally been the largest centre of Indonesian students in the Middle East, mostly Indonesians studying at the Islamic world's most venerable institution of higher learning, Al-Azhar University. But we also decided to add Turkey into the mix. Indonesian students going to Turkey is a more recent phenomenon. There's a much smaller Indonesian population there. But it's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, because the Turkey, particularly under the AKP, particularly under President Erdogan, has become something of a model for some Islamic groups in Indonesia. But also Turkey has become, as we all know, since 2011, a major kind of transit point for foreign fighters going into Syria. So we thought it would be interesting to have a look at, to interview some of the students in these two centres. The first thing we had to find, however, was someone to conduct the interviews, and this is where Nava came into the picture. Nava, at that point, was working at RSIS in Singapore. She volunteered to do the job, and in fact, she did such a good job that Sydney ended up giving her a job at IPAC. And really, Nava is incredibly central to the success of this report. We discovered in Nava a star interviewer, who was able to disarm most of these students and get them to kind of delve deep into their perceptions and their ideas about what they were seeing in the region. Historically, the Middle East has always played an important role in shaping Islamic thought and activism in Indonesia. Obviously, Indonesian Islam has developed largely in the reflection of local cultural and social outlooks. But there's always been a long tradition of Indonesians travelling to the Middle East, particularly as students, but also welcoming into Indonesia Middle Eastern preachers and also the ideas of Middle Eastern Islamic thinkers through the translation of Arabic language works. So it was going to be very interesting to see what this particularly turbulent period in Middle Eastern history was, what impact it was having on one of these main conduits for ideas from the Middle East to Indonesia. There were three particular events that we were focusing on in our interviews with the students. The first one, in terms of the Egyptian students, was the 2013 military overthrow of Egypt's elected President Morsi from the Muslim Brotherhood. This was an interesting event, not just in Egypt's history, but also in the context of the long debates that had gone on about Islamist parties and Islamist participation in democratic politics. And in particular, we wanted to see whether this episode and this, particularly the military's removal of Morsi, was in any way changing the thinking of those Islamists or those Islamic activists who were focused on democratic and parliamentary political participation. The other kind of event was, and this is really less an event but a kind of a period, and this is focused on the students in Turkey, was the some of the growing tensions around the by now kind of long-term Erdogan government and some of the moves that Erdogan was making, and the kind of sense that under Erdogan, Turkey was creeping towards a more authoritarian style of government, despite the fact that the Erdogan and the AKP had been repeatedly elected in generally free and fair elections. And you saw some of those tensions come to a surface, and certainly the Indonesian students, some of the Indonesian students in Turkey saw this as well, in 2013, when you had the kind of now infamous Gezi Park protests, kind of protests largely by secular Turks, calling for greater freedoms, that spread from Gezi Park in Istanbul to other major centres in Turkey. The third major incident, the third major event episode we talked to the Indonesian students about was the rise of Islamic State, of course. Certainly in Indonesia, particularly amongst a narrow or small group of extremists, that the rise of Islamic State has had some really serious implications, and it's being followed very quickly. We've seen small numbers of Indonesians travel to join Islamic State in Syria. We've seen some Indonesian extremists swear oaths of loyalty to Islamic State. So we wanted to get a sense from what was basically a mainstream group of students about how they saw the rise of Islamic State, in particular Islamic State's declaration of a caliphate. So that's a bit of a background to the report itself. I wanted to now just turn to Narva and talk a little bit about just some of the basics, some of the basic data kind of in terms of numbers of students. So Narva, if you want to kind of give us a rundown on students and the kinds of backgrounds of people that we talk to in Egypt and in Turkey.
Thanks, Anthony. It's great to be back in Sydney. And so we did 47 interviews in total. 40 interviews in total with 47 students in both Egypt and Turkey. And because some of the interviews we did in group, but the majority was one-on-one interviews. And in Egypt, I was only able to go to Cairo. We initially wanted to go to Mansoura and Samanud because that's where most of the Indonesian Salafi students are based. That's where they get, they went to some Salafi madrasas, because they have free lodging and they get stipend. That's why even though they officially they're enrolled in Al-Azhar in Cairo, but they this is the Salafis, they prefer to live in Mansoura or Samanud because they get a lot of they can go to the Salafi preachers and they get free stuff. But we stayed in Cairo because it was safer, and I was actually prohibited by the embassy to go out of Cairo. And but in Turkey, I was able to go to three places: Istanbul, Kayseri, and Izmir. The reason we went to Izmir and Kayseri was not just because of the Indonesian students are spread across different cities and regions in Turkey, but also because we had two Indonesians going over to join ISIL in Syria, and they were based in these two cities, the Kayseri and Izmir. And the gender composition we have, I'm a woman, so I have more advantage there in terms of interviewing female students. So we've got almost even. The men were still 2/3 and 1/3 was female respondents. But the women were especially very interesting because they give more colors to the interview, for example, because we were interested in which scholars or books the students read, especially in terms of Islamic thinking. And it's interesting that many Indonesian students in Egypt now, they go to these off-campus lectures, which was not very popular in the past, but it's getting more and more popular. The reason was because Al-Azhar wanted, for example, the students who sympathize with the Brotherhood, they do these off-campus lectures, and the Al-Azhar thought that if they don't provide these lectures themselves, then they would go to these dodgy preachers, right? And so they have these informal gatherings and study groups. This is where the students go. And for the women, sometimes the reason why they choose a particular sheikh or ustad is not just, first is the language factor. They like people who speak the formal Arabic rather than the colloquial Egyptian one. And also because they're handsome. And this is the things that you won't get from the men, you know, this kind of factor. Some of them even went all the way from Cairo to Alexandria to meet their favorite sheikh. And
can you also tell us a little bit about the breakdown in terms of, you know, some of the Islamic organizations in Indonesia that the students were affiliated with?
The students' organizations in Egypt, they have 17 regional organizations. That means half of Indonesian provinces, half of Indonesian 34 provinces were represented by the students in Egypt. Whereas in Turkey, you only have one regional organization, which is the Acehnis. Just because Turkey gave a lot of aid to Aceh after the tsunami. So then they started sending Indonesian students to study in Turkey. And we also have all the major Islamic groups like Nahdlatul Ulama, Muhammadiyah, the Islamic Unity or Persis. They were also present in Egypt, but not in Turkey, because in Turkey it's a relatively new destination. We have just over 700 students. There are not as many organizations. And we also have political parties represented by the students in Egypt and Turkey. So the Islamist Party, the PKS, the Justice and Prosperous Party, they have official representative branch in Egypt. But in Turkey, they have these informal student gatherings. But there's no official branch of PKS in Turkey, but they have these study groups to recruit the students, which is why they are having a fallout with the Nahdlatul Ulama student, because the Nahdlatul Ulama they have official representative, and they thought that the way the Islamists tried to recruit students was by deception, by misrepresenting themselves as a neutral study group. And this is where all the student politics coming out, and it also affected our research. For example, because I'm closer to the Nahdlatul Ulama and the Muhammadiyah side, so the Islamists were often suspicious of myself, but this was not a big problem in Egypt, because they were interested in voicing their opinions, like what they think about democracy and everything. But in Turkey, they were more suspicious because of the tension between the Nahdlatul Ulama students and the PKS ones.
Now, but one of the things that came through very strongly, and you saw this firsthand, was the strong perception of how different the cultural, how big the cultural differences were, the sense of, you know, Indonesian society and culture, and Indonesian being very, very different in both Egypt and Turkey. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how strongly that came through?
Yes, the students, one of the interesting things about cultural perception was that they think the connection between cultural perception and democracy, for example. They think that democracy suits Indonesia because we're all civilized people. We're soft, we're gentle, conflict avoidance, whereas the Arabs are very violent, harsh, and unruly. That's why democracy just doesn't work there. they just shout all the time. So when we were on the street, the students, my friends told me, look, people just shout. How can you ask me why democracy doesn't work here? It's because of the people.
There's a great quote that we've used, yeah, where one Indonesian student saying, well, look, only the prophet can control the Arabs, and if not the prophet, then the military.
If the prophet was sent to East Java, he wouldn't have been able to spread Islam to the Middle East, because the Middle East are just very unruly people.
But as you say, that there's a serious point there that had us impacted on how they judged the relevance of what they saw in Egypt and in Turkey, particularly in Egypt, for Indonesia. So one of the surprising results was the number of students in Egypt that supported the military coup against the elected Morsi government.
In fact, the majority of the students, except for the Islamist one, the PKS-affiliated students, they supported or at least saw the coup as necessary. They think that Morsi was too weak. He couldn't get anything done on the economic or to improve the economy or the just the national stability. So they thought that it was not only justifiable but also necessary for the military to take over. One interesting quote was saying that so what was the difference between the ouster of Mubarak and Morsi? He said, there's no difference. The people wanted them down, and the military merely helped the people to bring these leaders down. That's it. So it was like there were protesters in Tahrir who supported Sisi, who wanted Morsi out. So they said this, and they brought up all these numbers, which I don't know where it came from, but they thought that there were more people in Tahrir supporting the ouster of Morsi rather than those in Rab'ah who supported Morsi, and they said some of them even bring up Islamic theories or theological reasons why they should be a coup. It's for greater good. This idea that public interests matter most than democracy, or they even tolerate the clampdown on civil liberties at some to some point.
I mean, that was one of the interesting things that came out in the interviews, was the extent to which religion wasn't, in fact, a kind of key criteria by which they judged not just events like the coup, but also political leaders. And that came through very strongly in the kind of comparisons between the deposed Muslim Brotherhood president in Egypt, Morsi, and President Erdogan in Turkey. How did that reflect itself?
Oh, so they were more tolerant about the coup in...
The comparison between the two leaders, between Erdogan and Morsi.
So this came up to what the students think what an ideal leader should be. They think that an ideal leader should be those who could avoid all Morsi's mistakes, all his faults, but adopt Erdogan's strength. So, for example, the three top Morsi's weakness was, first, he was too fast. He was trying to do too much too fast. So, for example, he tried to implement Sharia, and then he replaced all the regional leaders. This is what the students think. The governors and the mayors with brotherhood people. And secondly, he was naive. He chose the revolutionary path instead of reform. For example, in terms of the annulment of the constitution and the implementation of Sharia. They think that he tried to formalize the Sharia, and this antagonized the mainstream Muslims in Egypt, and also he antagonized the military, which is bad. They thought, because you want to do good thing, democratization, yes, but don't upset the military too much, because then they would form this disgruntled front, they said, with all the oppositions to go against you. And then the third one was that Morsi just didn't perform, didn't deliver anything in terms of economy, for example. The prices of goods were up, and this is the things they thought that Erdogan managed to avoid, because Erdogan's strategy, according to the students, was that development first and Islamization later. So don't reveal your true color, don't reveal your Islamic identity at the very beginning. Like AKP, for example, they never said that they're Islamic party. They're just, normal political party. And so they thought that's a very good strategy. And they have no problem with most of them think that Erdogan did a great job in terms of infrastructure development, economic development, and also in terms of Sharia. They think that Erdogan didn't try to implement the Sharia, and that's good. So one of the conclusions that the student drew from Erdogan is that if you want to promote Islam, try to do it from secular party, non-Islamic party, so that you don't scare the people.
Thanks. Sydney, reading through the transcripts of the interviews, and there's a lot of them, some 700-odd pages of transcripts, what were the key things that struck you?
I think one of them was on how proud Indonesians were of their own democracy. And regardless of which of these political organizations they represented in Egypt and Turkey, they were all convinced for different reasons that democracy was the only solution for Indonesia. The one problem was you got a sense from some of them that they actually did want to have some form of Islamic government in the future, but that democracy was the best way to get there, and that it was a way of gradually bringing about Islamic values in the way that Turkey had, but in a way that brought the community together. So that was one thing. I think it was interesting how many of the Indonesians found analogies with local leaders. So their perceptions were molded by analogies in Indonesia. So for example, Morsi, in a way, was the Gus Dur or the Abdurrahman Wahid of Egypt. He was completely inept. And Gus Dur was completely inept as a president. The difference was that Gus Dur basically accepted his fate, sacrificed himself for the people, and once he was impeached, went quietly, whereas Morsi didn't. Sisi and in some ways Mubarak were the equivalent of Suharto, except that every time there was a comparison with Egypt, Indonesia came out better. Every time there was a comparison with Turkey, Indonesia failed by comparison. And I think the issue was that Erdogan got the sequencing right. He did the democracy first. People were looking at Jokowi, who also at the transition of some of the post-Suharto presidents that weren't focusing enough on deliverables after the transition. There was no sense at all that any of the Indonesian students would change the system they have, even though they were critical in some cases of the political systems in Egypt. I think the other thing that came through was on the Islamic State issue, because everyone that we talked to was against the Islamic State and very firmly against the Islamic State. And it's actually interesting that of all of the Indonesians who have joined the Islamic State, we could only find four that have come from schools in the Middle East. Now, there may be more, and there probably are a few more, but overwhelmingly, the people that have joined have come directly from Indonesia and not from studying abroad. And of the two kids in Turkey who did join, one of them had to go back to Surabaya to get the contacts that would enable him to cross the border from Turkey into Syria, because even though he was in Turkey, he didn't know how you get the contacts to go across, and it was only by making the contacts with a pro-ISIS group in East Java could he find the contact numbers to call in order to get across. And it's partly because if you're going to join Islamic State, you have to have somebody recommend you who's already in Syria. And he didn't have anybody who had that knowledge. Once he was across, he could recommend his friend, so his friend joined as well.
I want to come back to the story of those two students, because that was also quite an interesting part of some of the interviews. But one of the other fascinating things was the... how would you say it? The short memory of some of the students.
Oh, that was fascinating.
Within
yeah.
Indonesia, yeah.
Because As they were talking about some of the cultural differences, they said, they're talking about how violent the Arabs were, and they said, look at the difference in transitions. In the two coups in Egypt, or the two revolutions in Egypt, thousands of people died in each one. He said, when one student said, and when Suharto fell, there were only 7 people killed. And I thought, you're forgetting about Ambon, Poso, Aceh, Maluku, and not to mention all of the people that died in shopping malls and the attacks on the Chinese in Jakarta. It was as though violence had been completely airbrushed. And then he said, and when we had the transition from Sukarno to Suharto, nobody died at all. I thought, 65? I mean, it was extraordinary how their image of themselves was as quiet, gentle people who are always obedient to authority.
Yeah. So there was this case of these two young teenage Indonesians who came to Turkey on a Gulen Foundation scholarship, and through an interesting process found themselves in Syria, where one of them died, having joined Islamic State. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, because I think this particular story illuminates some of what might be done on de-radicalization issues. These were two teenagers, basically, who had gotten themselves into a Turkish-Indonesian school in Central Java. There are 9 of these schools around Indonesia now. And they were math and science focused. The schools were math and science focused. And these two kids were champions. They had won Olympiads. And they wanted to continue their studies. So when they got the opportunity to continue on in Turkey for high school, they signed up. Nobody told them that the high school they were going to end up in was a religious school. It wasn't a place where they were going to be able to continue their math and science. And from the beginning, they were miserable. They didn't want to be there. They felt they had been cheated. They felt they'd been tricked. And they gradually withdrew. And when they withdrew, they began watching video games and looking at videos of the fighting in Syria. And it became very clear to their friends, whom Nava interviewed, that they were watching these violent videos on a regular basis and were beginning to talk, particularly one of them, about joining up in Syria. They had nobody that they felt they could trust to report to on this. And the difference in Egypt was that there was a great attaché, educational attaché, at the Indonesian embassy that all the kids knew, and he interacted with them all the time. And if there was a case of somebody who wanted to go to Syria, you can believe that one of those students would have reported to this educational attaché. In Turkey, partly because everybody is spread out, there wasn't that kind of interaction with one individual, and these people didn't want to get themselves in trouble and didn't want to get their friends in trouble, so they just were quiet. And it raises the question about if somebody knew, could they have been prevented from going? But the second thing was that when the school found out that these two kids had gone, they immediately called an assembly, basically read the riot act to the students, also gave them the arguments for why the Islamic State was not a legitimate caliphate, and basically ensured that there would be no further departures from the school. I think monitoring also increased. But you think about, look at the number of students or people from individual schools who have left for Indonesia. If you'd had a government program in Indonesia that every time a student left or was found to have left, you had a kind of template where you called a school assembly, basically said this is not the right thing to do, gave them arguments about why it would be a burden on the parents, because the parent-student relationship, parent-child relationship is very important, and then gave them the same kind of arguments against the legitimacy of the caliphate. Maybe, just maybe, you might be able to prevent some additional people from leaving. But we don't have that kind of a program in Indonesia, and we don't have that kind of outreach against the Islamic State. This was also the case for the students at Al-Azhar. They got a steady diet from their instructors about why the caliphate wasn't legitimate. And they got it so often that they could parrot it back, and you got the same argument being given from one student to another. And there's something to be said for that kind of repetition over and over and over again, because these kids believed that argument so implicitly it had been internalized. And what was interesting is that even though they were not going to join the Islamic State, believed it was illegitimate, they also believed that the United States had created ISIS and the Syrian conflict in order to destroy Islam. So that was part of the conspiracy theories that they also believed, about half of, slightly less than half, gave you the arguments for the United States basically being behind the creation of ISIS.
And that tells you some interesting things about, you know, the kinds of, you know, CT messaging that we should be focusing on, I think, rather than, you know, and it was clear from the interviews that you know, one of the reasons that the students condemned Islamic State was its brutality, and was that the perception that they were dividing the Muslim community, they were killing other Muslims. But that legal argument also came through very, very strongly. And, you know, if you're going to run arguments that basically depend on depicting Islamic State as this bad guy in general terms, then you are going to run into, I think it was just over, you know, between a fifth and a quarter of the students who think, well, this is all US organized. But if you're running the legal argument, you're probably going to get a lot more, you're going to get a lot more capture, you're going to get a lot more support.
The other interesting thing is that a lot of the students that Nava interviewed saw the Syrian conflict purely in Sunni Shia terms. That was how they portrayed the conflict. And a plug for our next paper, Nava's been working on a report on the anti-Shia movement in Indonesia. And I actually think one of the big impacts back in Indonesia from the Syrian conflict is the perception of Shia as murderers of Sunnis and as violent and aggressive. In fact, one reason that some of the students in Egypt believe the coup was necessary is their argument, basically using the same argument that Sisi did, that if we didn't intervene, Egypt would become like Syria or like Libya and so on.
Well, can I take a liberty and ask you to give a bit of a preview of your next paper, or in terms of the shift, or is it still under wraps?
Still under wraps.
All right, okay. It's hard when the boss is sitting right next door. I'll now take a few questions from the floor. Please raise your hand, wait for the microphone, tell us who you are, and then ask a question.
Hey, Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute. Thanks very much for the presentation. I know you concentrated during the report on Islamic State, but did you track any opinions of the Indonesian students regarding other groups like Jabhat al-Nusra or other al-Qaeda affiliates, or was this strictly about attitudes regarding Islamic State?
Islamic State was the big gorilla in the room in some ways because of the concern that there might be students leaving, but did you get someone on this?
Well, the way I did it was to see if the students know anything at all about the Syrian conflict and see which groups they mentioned. And in fact, only a few of them knew about Jabhat al-Nusra. It was the woman who seemed to know more about these things, just because she went to the Ngruki, to the Bashir's school. And the rest, all they knew was mostly ISIS. Also because they knew, especially the students in Turkey, they knew that two students just left to join ISIS. And but most of them think that ISIS or Al Qaeda or anything was U.S. conspiracy at the beginning, at least. And all of them think that it's bad. You know, caliphate is a bad thing. Caliphate was only suitable for the past, but not for today. And they believe in the end of the world prophecy, the hadith that you know, that there are five phases of Islam, and the last phase would be going back to the caliphate. But they think that this caliphate, it's not something that you create. It's something that you wait. It's just gonna happen at the end of time, and this is not the end of time.
Although there is one of the strange elements of of the Indonesians that have gone to Syria has been this end of time kind of mythology, Sydney.
But I think that's been for everybody. It hasn't been just for the Muslims of Indonesia. Mm. But it's interesting that we do have Indonesians going to join al-Nusra, and we do have a very deep and bitter split among the Indonesians who are involved in the jihadi movement in Indonesia between those that are still affiliated or still see their affiliation to Al-Qaeda and the people who have switched to ISIS. And it breaks down along Jamaat Islamiyah, non-Jamaat Islamiyah lines. So basically, the JI leadership has stayed very pro-Nusra, whereas the non-JI people have almost entirely gone to ISIS. And we've had a few defections from JI to ISIS, but not very many. And now, one of the things that government agencies are doing is using al-Nusra propaganda against ISIS and circulating it in government websites and also organizing lectures as though they were being organized from within the jihadi community. Some of the intelligence people are doing it, but using al-Nusra documentation and in some cases speakers to try and bash the Islamic State.
Yeah.
Rob Thomas from LFG. Do you think part of the reason you're not seeing so many people, certainly Indonesian students, going from to Islamic State is a function that they're actually very well educated, and a lot of the messages, you know, that they might have been getting from whether it be madrasas or whatever, is actually they're actually able to process that information and actually make their own decisions around it. Whereas a lot of maybe the people you're actually seeing, whether it be Indonesians, it doesn't matter, going to Islamic State are the poorly educated people who actually can't make that distinction between the messages which they're actually getting and actually being able to process it and say that actually that doesn't make any sense.
I think that's definitely one of the reasons. But also there are other factors, like the reason why the students who went, why they went, was because of a whole range of factors, their sense of isolation, their sense of despair and disappointment, and also one of them. So after these two students left, I talked with four of their friends, and one of them said that I almost left, you know, I've packed my bag and everything. But then I called my parents, and you know, I just remembered my mom and my dad, and I was like, no, I can't go. I can't, you know, I can't get killed and make them sad. But on the other hand, there was another student in Egypt who was thinking of leaving, and his friends found out, and then he brought him around from one ustad, from one teacher to another to give him advice. But in the end, he went home. And nobody knew. Some people thought that he actually left for Syria, but that's because his father was also radicalized. So it was after knowing that, you know, his son was almost brought back to the right path, then the father sort of asked him to come home and re-radicalize him or something. And then some reports say that they went to Syria.
But I think that the students in Egypt represent a fairly well-educated group, but if you're talking about the level of education of the people who have gone to Syria directly from Indonesia, actually some of the better educated people with university educations have left, partly because of the money required, and most of the people who've left have been self-financed, generally, the people that have found the money to go have been somewhat better educated than you were if you were coming from a dirt poor village. Some of the people who have joined pro-ISIS groups are but who haven't left for Syria are very poorly educated and in the kind of lower economic classes, but it's a real mixture of socioeconomic status and level of education.
I mean, the great irony of these two students, that the case that we encountered was, they didn't go for religious reasons. It was they went because they got too much religion at the school they went to, and it led them into a kind of a personal conflict with with the people at the school. I mean, what you also touch on, I mean, one of the other things that came through very strongly was, you know, generally the sense that even if the students, you know, didn't necessarily understand what was happening in Egypt and Turkey completely well, that they were very discriminating and very critical observers of events. It was not so much a case of, well, it's happening in the Middle East and the Middle East has this authority in Islam, so therefore it's applicable to what's happening in Indonesia. They made some very, you know, tough-minded judgments about, well, this is the Arab world, this doesn't really apply. And in fact, I mean, I think in the case of Indonesia and Egypt, there are actually some, there were some greater similarities than the students kind of saw, but you know, they were very discriminating. And that goes to that kind of, you know, sometimes the idea that's thrown around that, well, if these, you know, these, you know, Indonesians from this idyllic form of Islam in Indonesia go to the Middle East, they become automatically radicalized. I mean, one of the things that came through very much in this study, but consistent with previous studies that I'm involved in, is that people aren't radicalized by and large in the Middle East. I mean, there are some specific cases in specific countries, particularly looking at the Saudi case, but by and large, people come back as they leave. And one of the ways that's reflected is that you know, people tend to go to the institutions or go and study with the Islamic scholars that reflect their existing outlooks in Indonesia. So Salafis tend to go to Salafi schools. People with more mainstream backgrounds go to mainstream schools. So it's not this case of people go there and suddenly exposed to this, exposed to extremist ideology and a change. By and large, they come back as they went.
And the other thing is they only hang out with each other. That one of the reasons you have these regional associations, so the people from West Java hang out with other people from West Java. People from Sulawesi hang out with other people from Sulawesi. And very few of them gather the facility in Arabic to mix very well with the locals, let alone understand their lessons. So one woman was asked whether she had many Egyptian friends, and she said, they give me their notes at exam time. And this was the only time, really, that there was any interaction with the Egyptians. It's mostly Indonesians talking to each other with the student associations being the major social gathering place.
But there's a difference between Al-Azhar and Cairo University, for example, because in Al-Azhar they have too many Indonesian and Asian students that it's not a rarity anymore. Whereas in Cairo University, when you're a foreign student, especially Indonesian, because there are not many of them, so the Egyptians are much more interested in becoming friends with them.
Oh, okay. Ji Hong Song from Louis Institute. I like to see from ISIS perspective, there has been some news reports about ISIS recruitment technique has been more sophisticated. They use emotions, they're more family oriented. So, and they're also approaching those sort of marginalized migrant group. For example, they're approaching Indonesian domestic workers in Hong Kong, and they're also approaching Tajik migrant workers in Moscow. So if I were an ISIS recruiter, I'll probably approach those student group, Indonesian students in the Middle East, in Turkey or Egypt. Have you come across any of those sort of more sophisticated using social media or other sort of technique? They've been approached by this radicalized group?
The thing is that we don't see much recruitment, deliberate systematic recruitment from ISIL on the students group, but there is more recruitment on migrant workers in Hong Kong. This is one of the things that I've been looking at personally as well. And it's much more difficult to approach the students in Egypt because they have this strong knowledge, so they can give a counter argument. Even the high school student in Turkey, when his friends tried to recruit him, and this friend after he left for Syria, and then they were still in contact on WhatsApp and Facebook. And when the friend sent him all this hadith about jihad, you know, it's personal obligation and everything, but he kept questioning him because he memorized Quran, and then he was from Aceh, so he had much in-depth religious knowledge than the friend who went to Turkey. He said, okay, you give me all these verses of jihad, give me a verse or hadith which says that it's allowed to go jihad without your parents' permission. And the ISIS guy couldn't give him anything. And so he said that there are a lot more hadiths saying that, you know, you have to obey your parents, you have to respect them, family first, and all that. And this is, so it's maybe that's one of the reasons why it's more difficult to approach the students. Whereas with migrant workers, they're much less educated, and they they have all this personal need to belong to a group and need to search for meanings in their life, especially because they came from poor background usually. And also, the case of migrant workers, it's not, they also have self-agency to some extent. So it's not just the jihadist groups reach out to the migrant group, but also the other way around. When they have study groups, they're looking for preachers to give them sermons or lessons, and they just came across this radical ustad.
No, but you found that they actually got money together to pay for the ticket of radical ustads to come to Hong Kong.
Yeah, this is the migrant workers. They help because they're much more internationalized than, say, most women in Indonesia. They speak good English, and so they not only give donations to the families of the jihadis in Indonesia. I mean, the families of jihadis who have been imprisoned or killed. And so they give monthly stipend even to some of these families. And they also contributed when some of the men from Indonesia couldn't get sufficient funding to go to Syria, they helped raise the money through their friends from the Middle East or the European fighters, for example.
But one of the interesting things is that we don't know about migrant communities, for example, in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere in the Middle East. We know about the Hong Kong group because of a particular constellation using social media that Nava found out about. But what's going on with the much greater numbers in the Gulf? We just have no idea. And I think it's something that people should be looking at.
I'm curious. I know your report was mostly about the views of events in the Middle East, but I'm also curious about how these students viewed Indonesian foreign policy, which under Jokowi has taken a renewed interest in the Middle East. And in particular, I know you were there last year, but in the last few months, there's been some really interesting developments. Jakarta hosted an OIC conference on Palestine. Jokowi sent his foreign minister to do shuttle diplomacy between Iran and Saudi Arabia. There were signs of this when you were there. Were people talking at all about Jokowi seeking to assert a sort of an Indonesian leadership role? I'm curious in particular because one of the things that comes through your report is this sense of almost an Indonesian sense of superiority, that Indonesians are more halus than the Arabs and therefore can do democracy and Islam at the same time. Do they believe that Indonesia has something to offer the Arab world in terms of leadership?
They didn't talk so much about foreign policy, but yes, they when you know when we asked them like what kind of lessons we should learn from the Middle East, and they say, no, it should be the other way around. The Egyptians in particular have to learn from the Indonesians because we have hundreds of ethnicities and languages, but we keep things together. Whereas in the Middle East, you only have Muslims and Coptics, and you know there are not that many Jews even. And they said, but they keep fighting all the time. See, this is one thing they have to learn. And also in Turkey, even though they admire the economic development and everything, but they also think that the Indonesian motto of unity in diversity is way better than the Turkish approach to the Kurds, for example.
There was also one other wonderful story that comes out of the interviews, which was on Palestine, because while no one that Nava interviewed talked about Indonesia playing a peacemaking role at all. I mean, that's a figment of somebody's imagination in Jakarta that it's possible. There was this, one of the NU students who supported the coup in Egypt was basically saying that the military, he was very pro-Palestine as well as all Indonesian students are, and he was saying that the military actually did the Palestinians a favor by closing the Rafah tunnels that Morsi had opened to allow more goods and transport back and forth. And he said, because once the tunnels were open, all these Palestinians started coming into Egypt. And it meant that if you carried that to a logical conclusion, if you kept the tunnels open, there wouldn't be anybody left in the West Bank, or anybody left in Gaza to provide resistance to the Israelis. So therefore, by closing down the tunnels, you've basically increased the resistance of the Palestinians to Israel. And I thought, for a convoluted argument, that one's hard to beat.
Thank you. Jeff Miller from the Institute of International Affairs. Just a different aspect, really, and in a way, I shouldn't be asking this question because you're talking about what's happening in the Middle East, but something that's very commonly talked about, and most recently by, I think, President Obama himself, is Arab-funded radicalizing preaching in Indonesia. And I wondered whether that's increasing or ebbing or at the standard level, and how effective you think that is.
There's certainly, beginning in the late 80s, a flood of Saudi money, not necessarily some from the government, but also a lot from individual donors, going for the propagation of basically Wahhabism in Indonesia. And it's led to the establishment of a number of different schools, but many of the Salafi groups are also divided among themselves. It's also led to a proliferation of media, both print and electronic media, that promote a Salafi point of view. And we've seen many Indonesian students come back from certain universities in Saudi Arabia, not all of them, imbued with a Wahhabi perspective. And it's of growing concern to not to ulama in particular, but also to Muhammadiyah, that their own ranks have been affected by this growing Salafi element, still very much a minority. But the sense is that even though funding dried up substantially after 9/11, that A, it may have started up again through private donors, and secondly, there was enough of a critical mass to keep building that core. So we're talking about a minority, but we're talking about one that is of increasing concern to the mainstream organizations.
I'll just add a little bit. So over the course of my interviews for the anti-Shia report, I heard many complaints from the Salafis about the decreasing funding from the Saudi and the Qatari. One thing they said that I particularly remember was that in the past, you can get funding for ideological programs, which is like education of preachers or publication of anti-Ahmadiyya, anti-Shia books. But these days, you get more chance to get funding if you build schools, like physical buildings. And so that's one of the ways that they try to get this funding. So maybe they only use, you know, some parts of the money to build mosque or school, but they could also use it for other stuff. So because all these money transfers are being closely monitored by the government, one of the ways that they tried to circumvent this restriction was, so these Salafi Ustadh have this Umrah and Hajj, like it's a travel agent, essentially. And so every couple of months or so, they bring 30, 40 people to Mecca for Umrah. And when they're there, they met with the representative of the donors, and they get money all in cash. And they divide it between the 30, 40 people they brought in. And so then they would collect the money again once they return to Jakarta. So that's how they got away with the $10,000 limit.
A couple of questions. Yemen, you obviously didn't go to for obvious reasons, but there has been a reflux of people from the Yemen. Would you have had a different answer if you'd gone there and talked to the students, do you think? And secondly, I suppose it reflects the Shia-Sunni divide as well in Yemen.
I was involved in a report on Indonesian students in Yemen now 4 or 5 years ago, and that's still available online. And that was really looking, it wasn't so much that, it wasn't going there to interview the students, it was just looking at what was the Indonesian presence in Yemen, which grew quite dramatically in a very short space of time. And we were looking at some of the reasons why it grew, and what kinds of institutions they were going to in Yemen. What's not, now at that point we were looking at around somewhere between 1,600 and 2,400 students spread across a range of institutions, from very formal universities to kind of informal Salafi institutions in Yemen. It's not clear what's happened to those Indonesian student numbers since the start of the Yemeni civil war. I suspect some of them are still going, and particularly those schools in Hadhramaut that has been less affected by the civil war. But it's certainly an area that would also be very, very interesting to look at. I don't think we'll be sending Nava for interviews there. Maybe we'll wait for people to come back.
It's interesting that the Yemeni war has basically exercised the Salafi community in Indonesia more than the conflict in Syria. That initially, when the Syria conflict first broke out, there was an unusual meeting of the minds of the Salafi and the Salafi jihadis in Indonesia, that this was evil Shias massacring Sunnis. And so you had a partnership for a very brief period of time. And then the ISIS people started going after the Salafis as well. And you began to get a division again, but the Salafis in Indonesia were paying more attention to the evil Shia in Yemen, presumably encouraged by their Saudi patrons.
It's time to wrap. Thank you for joining us today. As I said, the report is up on the website. There are also some hard copies here, so take a copy as one of the co-authors. I can heartily endorse it. It's a great, riveting read. And please join me in thanking our guests today, Nava and Sydney. And we'll see you next time.